I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. When I walk into a grocery store, it's not too long before I find my way to the meat aisle. I might pick up some ribs, a steak, some chicken wings, and this all seems quite normal. But occasionally as I'm doing this, as I'm passing down the aisle, I realize that the rows of nicely packaged meat that I'm looking through are really large quantities of animal parts and flesh. And then I wonder, is this normal? Is it normal to eat animals? And even if it is normal for humans to eat animals, isn't it kind of strange that humans have come to love animals so deeply in so many ways, yet our methods of agriculture, farming, and meat processing are widely known to promote animal cruelty? How do we reconcile the suffering we inflict upon animals in the food industry with our love for animals? And how does veganism seek to change the course we are on? I'm joined today by Dr. Corey Wren. Corey is a UK-based American sociologist and scholar of social movements and human-non-human relations. She is the author of several books, including A Rational Approach to Animal Rights, Extensions in Abolitionist Theory, and Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits. In 2013, she founded the Vegan Feminist Network, a coalition of vegan women advocating for intersectional awareness and solidarity across social justice issues. Her work has been featured in the BBC, the Huffington Post, and Women's Health Magazine. Corey, thank you so much for joining me.
Yay, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks, Zale.
So you're really a worldwide expert in the realms of animal abuse, veganism, and so many other issues as they relate to animal activism. I think a good place to start off is by talking about our mistreatment of animals, because everybody knows that the food industry severely mistreats animals, yet it's something that we accept or we choose to ignore, and it's become the preconception that what we do is normal. What is the actual scope of animal abuse that occurs in agricultural and the food industry?
Well, it really is very, very difficult to condense into a soundbite because the scale, the scope is so astronomical. In fact, when we do our research on just the numbers of non-human animals who are killed every year for us to consume, we have to exclude fishes and other animals that live in the ocean and lakes because it's just impossible to even count the number of animals that we kill for consumption each year. It's astronomical. And, you know, the treatment, of course, varies across different countries and cultures. But in general, I do have issue with the word mistreatment and abuse, because both of those words assume that non-human animals are ours to use, and we can just don't abuse them, use them nicely, and don't just mistreat them, treat them nicely, instead of, you know, thinking more about what about liberation, what about this concept that animals are not ours to be using as we please in the first place. So it's not a matter of just treating them nicer. It's a matter of resisting that use and treatment altogether. So if we're looking at the violence that they are experiencing, most of us in the animal rights movement today focus quite a lot on the food system because that's where the bulk of the suffering is happening. Although some folks would push back on that and say we should also be paying attention to the non-human animals who have been displaced or poisoned or quote unquote hunted. I don't like the word hunted. I think that it's kind of a euphemism. So non-human animals in the food system, and then those indirectly killed because of that food system, are kind of the main area where a lot of that suffering is happening. Historically, we focus a lot on vivisection, aka animal testing, but while that's still a major industry, it's not anywhere near the number of non-human animals that are killed and harmed in food. So I could give you the rundown on this. You know, people can read more about that, but if you want to know what happens in farms and, you know, in battery cages and gestation crates and the slaughterhouse line and all that sort of stuff, I think a lot of us already know intuitively, have an idea of what happens. We just don't want to think about it.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is just what we choose to really register. I'm not a vegan, as I said in that introduction, I'm not a vegetarian. But when I'm thinking about the meat that I'm purchasing, I'm often kind of dissociating to a degree and thinking, okay, well, the chicken that I'm eating isn't one of those chickens that I'm seeing up in a coop where there's just thousands of chickens being put in really no place to move around, or one of those cows that's really just being raised to the slaughter. But most of the food that we eat, really, in short, without getting into the detail of it, it is being processed in that way, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And I think one thing I would highlight is that a lot of the humane washing, greenwashing sort of campaigning that the meat and dairy industries have been up to in the past few decades has been really effective. So when I introduce myself and it comes up in conversation that I'm vegan, one of the first things that a non-vegan, non-vegetarian person will say to me is like, I almost always buy my meat that's humanely raised, and I only buy cage-free eggs or organic milk. And I'm like, okay, that doesn't really, you know, alter the fact that these animals are being really, really harmed, really significantly harmed, even in the tiny fraction of those animals that are coming from quote unquote happy farms. They're still meeting with gruesome fates in the slaughterhouse. And first off, I want to highlight that it's only about 1% of the food that we're animal products that we purchase actually come from those quote unquote happy farms. But if you actually do your research and look into it, you'll see that, you know, they're objects, they're consumable objects just the same. And although the farmer might pet them on the head, they're still going to send them off to slaughter. These animals will still be castrated without anesthesia. They'll still be debeaked and decombed without anesthesia. Some piglets will have their teeth cut out so that they don't bite each other in stress. And if you've seen images, so quote unquote, the happy egg farms, you see that they're just in one big cage, and thousands of them in these big cages. And so it's still just as miserable. So I think that, you know, even if it's this happy, humane stuff, like this is a labeling campaign that has been extremely effective, and people can feel good about the stuff they buy. And I want to say this is not just in meat and dairy. I mean, we all need to be conscious about any of the food we eat, because, you know, even non-animal products will have labeling schemes on them to kind of persuade you to buy. You know, say it'll be some super sugary cereal, but they'll blast on the front of the box like high in vitamin D or whatever. You're like, well, this must be healthy. And it has pictures of like nature on the box. Oh, it must be healthy. So we have to remember that just like we'd be skeptical of any food product with the labeling and the kind of branding that they use, the same thing happens with non-human animals. We cannot escape the fact that if you're using another animal for your consumption, for products that aren't required for health and aren't required to sustain you, there's going to be some use and abuse going on and behind the scenes.
So when we're talking about the abuse of animals, and it's a rhetorical question because I know there is a cognitive dissonance, but there is such a massive cognitive dissonance that takes place in society. On the one hand, we severely abuse animals, as we've talked about. And on the other hand, people love animals. People have pets that they treasure and spend thousands of dollars on. Kids, most of their favorite fictional characters are animals. I wrote a blog recently and I showed it to some friends, and some of them it resonated, some of them it didn't really, but I was talking about the Peppa Pig phenomenon, how right now Peppa Pig is a hugely popular character amongst kids. But isn't there some irony in the fact that kids are loving Peppa the Pig, and you could apply this to any other show pretty much which has an animal, but much of the time they might even be eating bacon while they're watching Peppa the Pig. How is that cognitive dissonance developed to such an extent?
Yeah, it's such, I think that honestly, the animal rights movement, one of the biggest advantages that we have is the fact that human beings are social beings. We really gravitate towards other beings. And it's, I don't think that it's something we necessarily have to teach kids to love other animals. This is something that's innate within us. But then, of course, in order to make them fall in line with cultural trends and what we're expected to consume, power dynamics and all that sort of stuff, it has to be sort of trained out of them. I will say, this summer at the International Association of Vegan Sociologists, we had a conference, and one of our members actually presented on Peppa Pig and has just published a paper on that. So it might be interesting to your listeners. Yeah, but basically what happens, we have a lot of folks who specialize in childhood socialization. The ones I would recommend is Matthew Cole and Kate Stewart. It's a couple who live here in England, and they've written a whole book called Our Children and Other Animals. And they basically go through how, you know, as kids, we gravitate towards other animals. There's a very famous meme that floats around in the animal rights movement where they have a baby sat between an apple and a bunny. And it's basically asking, you know, let the baby be the baby, and which do you think the baby's going to eat, and which do you think the baby's going to pet? You know, the baby's going to maybe try to eat the apple, but it's not going to eat. They're going to want to play with the rabbit, because that's us as social beings. So that really has to be trained out of us. So when you talk about cognitive dissonance, that really gets into the realm of psychology, and there's a whole lot of vegan psychologists who are doing good work on that. But in sociology, what we tend to focus on is socialization. So where we try to teach our children in order to behave in certain ways and develop their attitudes and values in certain ways. So childhood, of course, is where the primary socialization happens. But as they get older, even throughout our entire life course, we're experiencing secondary socialization. So Zale, I'm sure like when you go to eat with your friends or family, you may feel certain pressure to eat a certain way. If you deviate from that, you know, be pushed back in line in a certain way. And anyone who's been vegan for a while, of course, has experienced that when people stigmatize them or punish them for that. So it's very strange that you point that out, that the kids love animals so much and it's such a big part of our childhood. And then as we get older, that starts to fall away. We've actually got new research that's coming out. It's like cutting edge stuff. It hasn't actually been published yet, but I just had a presentation last month where you can see that drop off happens in the early teens of a child. So the attitudes that are much more inclusive to animals and much more against violence to animals, that starts to drop away as a child enters their preteens. And then, of course, by young adulthood, it's almost gone. So there's definitely a lot of pressure happening from parents, medical institutions, doctors, education systems, which, by the way, the meat and dairy industry funnels lots of materials into. So it is strange that we're taught to love other animals on one hand, but you will see, if you look very critically, a lot of this stuff that we're teaching children is that animals are other and animals are ours to use, and we are more superior than those animals. So it's certainly a developing field in sociology and psychology as well.
You know, a lot of people listening to this would say, yes, I love animals and I appreciate animals, and the way we use and abuse them, that is not a good thing. But they would also maybe say, okay, but it's normal in the animal kingdom, in the world, that animals eat each other. Humans have evolved, some would say, our teeth in order to eat animals that we call meat. So if we were to do it in a more humane way, and I know we talked about what that actually means, but in the wild, and let's say it was really a humane way, is that natural, or is, in your view, that not natural?
Yeah, well, it's not natural. I mean, that's just bad science. First off, I challenge anyone to go out into the forest with their so-called canine teeth and take down some game. You're not going to do it. So humans, as we've developed as different cultures in our societies in order to gravitate more and more towards animal products as we develop technology, a lot of traditional cultures across the world have relied on an almost plant-based diet. So this concept that we must eat meat, it's naturally to eat meat, that's very much so a Western kind of narrative. And they also, the philosophical kind of counter there where you say, well, animals do it, so we're animals, shouldn't we also participate in that? Well, I think that's a real slippery slope, because I tell you what, my dog likes to eat cat poop and my dog likes to lick her butt. a lot of animals will cannibalize. A lot of animals will kill their babies. A lot of animals rape. So I don't know if we want to use other animals as kind of the litmus test. Okay, they do it, so it must be okay for us to do whatever they do. Because we have developed with larger brains, we have developed moral code and ethical code. And, you know, that's been advantageous to us as a social species. It's been very, very useful for us to develop these kind of these morals and ethics to help us be a stronger species. So I don't think that we should just have a free-for-all just because some animals eat other animals. A lot of animals don't eat other animals. So why is it that we choose the ones who are carnivorous and ignore the ones who are vegetarian? I think a lot of this is actually predicated in a patriarchal society that's based on dominance as the norm. And it's also based on, like I said, that Western narrative that animal products are somehow natural, when in fact, a lot of cultures, they weren't natural.
I liked how you mentioned our brains there, because in a sense, yeah, maybe at some point, even in the evolution of Homo sapiens, we maybe even were more naturally carnivorous. I don't know, and I don't know the biology of it, but regardless where we are now, our brains have evolved to such a point where our psychology and our morality perhaps supersedes that more primal instinct, if we did have that primal instinct at one point.
But we didn't. No, our bodies are more like vegetarian, like the other vegetarian apes. Our bodies are not really designed to eat meat like a regular carnivore. So that's just wrong. So you can cross that off the list.
Okay.
I think the other argument that, you know, other animals do it, so why shouldn't we, and like, take opportunities where you can, I think that's a little bit more of a valid argument. But again, just because we can doesn't mean we should.
A lot of this relates to society's perspective on animals, and you've alluded to this division between non-human and human animals. And it seems like you think that that's too rigid, and that there is this hierarchical view, and no doubt which exists, where humans view themselves as at the top of the hierarchical pyramid in this world, and everything else is inferior to us. Is that fundamental social division that we've created in our minds one of the real bases for this whole problem that's developed?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So this was one of the reasons why I started the Vegan Feminist Network back in 2013, because I felt like the animal rights movement kind of lacked a lot of that awareness to these larger structures and how they actually permeate other social relations beyond just humans and other animals. The vegan feminist kind of doctrine has been around for a long time. There's been women who are suffragettes, feminists who are advocating for women's rights and also for animal rights, and were very much so anti-vivisectionists or vegetarian back in the 1800s. We experienced another surge of that in the 1970s and 80s and 90s with the modern animal rights movement, the second wave of animal rights movement, also coinciding with the second wave of the feminist movement. And it was really bringing home this idea that what's happening to non-human animals is not happening in a vacuum. This is part of a larger logic of dominance, of oppression. And we can see a lot of overlaps and a lot of similarities between what happens to non-human animals and what happens to other marginalized groups. So this, I think, is really at the forefront of vegan theory, vegan thinking today, is that increasingly we're moving away from that very specific human-animal relationship and realizing that it's this larger framework that really needs to be unpacked. And increasingly, I don't think it's as popular as it should be, but it's certainly for the rise in vegan sociology, where we recognize that it's not just this kind of patriarchal dominance or colonial dominance, but it's also got a lot to do with capitalist dominance.
At the core of veganism, you've described it in some of your works as a political act of refusal. Mm. When you say a political act of refusal, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that veganism gets stereotyped quite a lot about being, you know, about what we eat as being a diet or a vegan lifestyle, but that's not what it's really about. Yes, vegans, we love our food. We are all about our food. I think another stereotype is that we just eat leaves and twigs, but in fact, there's a huge food culture with veganism. But because of that, because of this, it's about what we eat. It really becomes about, you know, things that we purchase, identity politics. And we don't actually hear in the mainstream media the fact that veganism is not just about, well, I'm going to eat clean today, or this is what's cool. In fact, it is a political position. And it's also important to recognize it in that way because, as I hinted at, you know, capitalism is a major, major force to reckon with when we're thinking about liberating animals. And another misnomer is that, well, if I go vegan, this many animals will be saved because I have not purchased this many animals this year. That's that many animals free from the slaughterhouse or whatever. But that's not how capitalism works. Capitalism creates demand where there was no demand. It creates new demand. It increases demand, which is why we eat so much animal products today. And for people who recognize that, that, you know, just because I went vegan, it's not going to free this many animals, it's important then to realize that even if it isn't directly liberating animals every time you choose vegan, it is still important as a political position. So for instance, like today I had my little activism stunt. So I have a subscription craft beer delivery thing, and they delivered it to me, and there was one bottle in there that wasn't vegan. So I called them up today and I was like, listen, I really, really appreciate that all these other beers were vegan. And then the magazine that came along with it, was all these vegan recipes. But it's like very clear to me that for them, veganism was like some kind of lifestyle that you kind of dipped your toe in as a hobby. And I said to them, like, listen, this is not acceptable for me. It's not going to work. And me making that stand and me saying, I'm not going to buy your beer anymore because I'm vegan. Like, is it mean that, oh, I've saved that one cow because I rejected that one bottle of stout. That's not going to happen. Right. But what the difference was, is when I called them and said, you know, this is my voice, this is my ethical position, this is why this isn't acceptable, and this is what would be acceptable. And the woman and the operator on the phone said, actually, we had a few people call about that. And so that's the political stance. We're building that culture. We're making that political position known, even if it's not directly at this time creating a dip in demand for animal products, because capitalism is smarter than that. Capitalism is now encroaching into places that didn't eat dairy before, that didn't eat a lot of meat before. So now you see places like India, one of the biggest exporters of meat and dairy, when traditionally they'd eaten a very plant-based diet. China as well. Most people in Asia are lactose intolerant. In fact, it should be lactose tolerance should be what we call it, because that's the unusual thing, globally speaking. It's a European phenomenon. But now, because that's what the West does, and because capitalist interests in countries like America and Ireland that produce a lot of animal products are actually going into these places and creating markets. Like, so capitalism is smarter than that. So it's about creating a political resistance, a cultural shift, not so much about I'm voting with my dollar. So that's why I say that this is a political position.
So is it equally a political position against hierarchy, against capitalism, as you described, just as much as it's about the actual notion that we should not be eating animals, let alone harming them?
I think so. I think that a lot of vegans, however, who they may not have that kind of larger theoretical backing to it, they just know they don't want to see animals suffer, and so they don't want to participate in it. But for me, you know, being an academic and, you know, writing books on this and, you know, being sociologically trained, for me, and a feminist, and I recognize that this is bigger than that. It is about this larger. So this is why you see a lot of vegans who are extremely left-leaning. A lot of them might be socialists, identify as anarchists, because they recognize it's about this really corrupt relationship with the state and this corrupt relationship that the state has with industries that's problematic here.
There certainly is a stigma about being vegan, and there was one statistic that I read in one of your articles which shocked me. It said that there was another study that suggested nearly half of animal studies scholars feel stigma in their profession, and that's not even vegans. But I think that reflects this notion of what it means to be vegan and what it means to encompass those values. Do you find that that stigma is very much still alive, that when somebody finds out you're a vegan, they associate a lot of general philosophies with you, maybe which are true?
No, absolutely. I do. I will say this. When I was in graduate school, my supervisor, he told me, when you go on the job market, you need to mask your animal focus and make yourself a social movement scholar, which I did. And I am a social movement scholar today. Obviously, I still do animal stuff. It's all animal stuff. But I come from a social movement kind of framework. And I know that when I went on the job market and I applied so many places, that it wasn't desired. hired, it wasn't wanted. And none of the job ads that you see, we need someone who specializes in animals in society. We just don't, which to me, I think is absolutely ridiculous. So for instance, back when COVID really hit, I submitted an article to the American Sociological Association. They put out a call for COVID-related things for their magazine. And the piece was called, Is Sociology Ready to Take Animals Seriously Now? And they rejected it. And I took that same article right over to the British Sociological Association, and they immediately published it. So of course, in England, it's a longer kind of vegan history here. And veganism, I think, is a little bit more normative here. But it's clearly not even like outside of the discipline, but within the discipline, there is a stigma against what we do is seen as not being important. When I just want to tear my hair out, because when we're looking at the coronavirus, where does it come from? It doesn't fall from the sky. It came from our problematic relationships with other animals. End of. That's where it came from. But we're still not ready to talk about it. It's unreal to me. So yeah, there is certainly that stigma. Although I do count my lucky stars that I was hired here at the University of Kent. And they specifically hired me because they saw, they're quite, you know, innovative in this way. They saw that vegan sociology really is on the horizon and it's going to be more and more important. It's kind of, you know, cutting edge stuff. I'm so glad that they agree. And so I have the amazing privilege that since I've started working here, I can not hide behind other theory, social movements or whatever. I can go straight into what I feel is most important to our field.
I think part of the reason it's stigmatized is because it's viewed as extreme. But one thing I've realized doing this podcast, the word extremism is sometimes...
it's politicized.
Veganism and the philosophy you're talking about will sound extreme, as you're aware, to many people listening to this who eat meat and who eat eggs and cheese on a daily basis. People like myself. But if we look at things that are very different from the norm and we just label them as extreme and then we associate that with negativity... that's really unfair, because just because a view is very, very different, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means it's a very, very different view and it's challenging the preconception of what's normal. And I think that that's really reflected when we look at the way veganism is viewed.
And yeah, I think you're so right to pick up on that word extreme and also radical. You toss that on anyone or anything and immediately it flags to the audience, don't pay attention, dismiss them. But for me, I would say, I think it's just mind-boggling that I would be considered extreme when, how can you get any more extreme than saying, well, I fancy a hamburger today, so let's go stick a bolt gun into this animal's brain so we can chop them up and eat them. Like, to me, that's extreme. What also is extreme to me is that people will, well, I want some breast milk today. They'll go take the breast milk from another species. It's not even an ape, it's a bovine. And drink the breast milk that's meant for a calf of a completely different species and, you know, put sugar in it, make milkshakes, freeze it, make ice cream. Like, to me, that's extreme. But nothing is more extreme when we feel like it's totally acceptable to go kill other sentient beings. You know, the same capacity for love, for hope, for friendship, for suffering, for pain, for fear. They don't want to die just like us. And we feel like that we can do whatever we want to them just because their bodies taste good or their breast milk tastes good or their menstruation, i.e. chicken eggs, tastes good. To me, that's extreme, because for most of human history, we've eaten a plant-based diet. That's norm. That's the normal. This extreme kind of animal eating culture in the large scope of things is a very small blip in human history. And it's, again, as I said, it's very kind of Western focused. Hunter-gatherers is only a recent economy that human societies have had. Before that, humans were mostly gatherers and they were mostly vegetarian. They scavenged whatever they could eat. I mean, I guess you could call them omnivores, but the archaeology is clear. They were eating mostly plant-based. When landscapes shifted about 10,000 years ago, hunting became a little bit more easy or realistic. It was still extremely dangerous. And so people still relied quite heavily on plant stuffs and berries and fungus and all that good stuff. But really, you're right. When we move to that agricultural type of society, that also very importantly coincided with domestication, the domestication of other animals, which David Nybert actually calls domestication, because it was at the core a violation of these non-human animals to make them docile, to contain them so we can fatten them up and eat them. So this concept of to own another, to completely dominate another for your convenience, for your profit or whatever it may be, that is a fundamental framework that reverberated throughout human societies. And we certainly see that kind of rise coincided, that coincided with the rise of dominating women, this concept of paternity. When we had domestication, suddenly earlier peoples recognized that conception wasn't just a magical thing that happened. Conception was locked in with this, with mating and all that sort of stuff. And so they figured out paternity. So then all of a sudden it was very important to control their women. Women were seen as livestock. In fact, that's where the term husband comes from husbandry, to kind of dominate your chattel, women and other animals. So this logic, and that's the kind of the core of vegan feminism and vegan intersectional thinking, is that these processes, these frameworks, they all kind of emerged together, which is, it's fascinating, but also really, it's quite grim. The last bit on there was class. So, you know, I think we should also recognize that class comes into play, because with agriculture, for the first time, you had surplus product. It wasn't just hand to mouth anymore. You had extra product being made. So some people could sit out. They may be guards or warriors or wise men or religious people, whatever it may be. And so then you start to see class structure forming. So yeah, it all starts with when we start to settle down, and then start to domesticate, i.e. domesticate non-human animals.
So you're saying when you talk about vegan feminism, you're talking about under the umbrella of vegan feminism that this all kind of developed together, our approach to non-human animals, really mirrored in many ways or maybe influenced our patriarchal type of society. One thing I want to distinguish for people is veganism from vegetarianism. And I think everybody knows the difference in the definitions there. But we've established that as a vegan, you don't think that it's right to eat animals at all. When you talk about things like eggs and cheese, dairy products, do you have the same stance that those things should not be eaten at all? Or is it more so the system in which we've come to produce and manufacture dairy products?
Let's put it this way. If you came to me and says, Corey, well, should I eat this steak or should I drink this glass of milk? Which one is more morally problematic? I'd say eat the steak. That glass of milk has got way more suffering in it than
really?
That steak does. Yeah, absolutely. So first off, that steak, that meat, that hamburger that you're probably eating, that a lot of it comes from dairy cows. So we have this kind of fantasy in our mind that cows just kind of emerge on some beautiful field and they just give milk flows freely. No, they have to be impregnated. They have to be impregnated. So they'll be put up on racks, and you want to see, it's glorious stuff. And by glorious, I mean hideous, how these cows are inseminated. So they put up on racks. And a farmer, almost all the time, they're men, right? So you have this man who has a glove all the way up to his shoulder, and he goes behind these restrained cows, who are babies, by the way. These dairy cows can live up to 20, 25 years, but they're all sent to slaughter by 5 or 6. So he will have these cows lined up in a row, and he goes down the row, and he inserts his arm, his whole arm, into her rectum to push down her uterus, then goes in with an insemination stick to into her vagina. And he just goes down the road, does that. And if anyone can watch that and not say this is some sort of sexual assault, it's just astonishing. So it begins there when you have these babies who are basically assaulted by these farmers, because we had this idea that they were like naturally mating out in a field with a bull. That's not what happens, because this is an industry. So then the cows become pregnant. If the cow, the baby cow is a boy, that cow will go off to veal. So that's a whole nother horrific kind of experience. Some of them will be raised a little bit, be allowed to live a little bit longer to fatten up and go to some kind of meat processing. A lot of the female calves will also meet the same fate. Some of those female calves will be put right back into the system. So they'll meet the same fate that their mothers do. Will they be sexually assaulted? They have to go through these pregnancies. In the U.S., about 25% of dairy cows have an infection of the udder called mastitis, which leads to a lot of pus and blood, which gets into the milk. And the USDA allows a certain percentage of that to be in the milk because it's impossible not to have in there, because in these conditions where they're being forcibly impregnated over and over in confined conditions around hundreds of other cows, it's horrific. So obviously this is a system where any living body would not be able to withstand it very long. And in fact, dairy cows are the same. After 4, 5, 6 years, they're sent to slaughter and then they become meat. So yeah, it's a horrific system all the way through. None of them actually are even adults. They're all babies that this is happening to. And a lot of times these bobby calves, the boy calves, will just be shot on sight. So we had that problem in Ireland earlier this year because of disruption. They just had this skyrocketing, they wanted to increase their milk production. But then, of course, when you increase milk production, you increase baby production because the babies come with the milk. And so they just could not get rid of these baby calves fast enough. So the farmers were just going out and shooting them with a gun a day or two after they were born. So there, it's a horrific, horrific, horrific system. And at the end of the day, we don't need cow's milk. It's not even a species near us. It causes all kinds of health problems. It's full of cholesterol. They have to fortify it with vitamins. Why not drink part of the litany of other plant milks that we have that tastes just great, in my opinion? It's a similar thing with the egg industry. We have this idea that eggs just kind of magically appear, but these eggs from these chickens are forced to produce hundreds of eggs in their short lives, when in nature they would only produce a few. And when these eggs are produced, of course, it's a huge drain on their body, because all the nutrients that go into producing that egg from their tiny little bodies, they become spent very quickly and they go off to slaughter. And I've seen one report that said 95% of those chickens, when they make it to slaughter, have broken bones because they're just so frail and beat about by the time they make it there. And then, of course, what happens to the boy chicks who can't replace their mothers? And so this is the same deal with people who have so-called happy hens that come from their neighbor or whatever. Most of these people are getting their chickens from mail order catalogs, or they all come from factories. And when those little baby boys are hatched, they have people who sit along the line. When the chicks hatch, as soon as they hatch, it's the saddest thing. The little girls will be chucked into a crate to be sold, and the little boys will be emacerated in an industrial grinder. Sometimes they'll be suffocated, be thrown in a bag and tied off. That happens with turkey chicks, which are a little bit larger. So in the few minutes that they exist on this earth, all they know is suffering at the hands of humans. It's horrific.
Wow. You used the word horrific. I don't think that anybody listening to that would disagree with that. Let's say this is a hypothetical, but I'm just curious how deep it stems. If you were in the wild, for example, and there were eggs that you saw that were available for consumption, would you view that in a vacuum as immoral to eat those? Or is...
I just don't see it as food. I mean, I see that as another animal trying to raise a family. And if other animals come and eat the eggs, fine, but that's not for me. You know, if anybody listening really wants eggs, I tell you, I produce one every month and you're welcome to it. It's produced humanely and no one suffered, and I consent. You can have it. But I don't think that I don't see this as food. It's a chicken embryo. It's a chicken egg. It's like menstruation. It's just not, I don't see it as food.
Part of it's the labeling that we do of things. Like when I said at the very beginning, you go to the meat aisle, it's just so normalized the way we talk about it. We talk about eggs, but when you think about it, yeah, that's an embryo. When you talk about meat, well, no, that's the rib of an animal. And for some people, I think it's easier and it doesn't affect them at all when they change the terminology. But for some people, I know for me, when I think about meat in terms of what am I actually eating, or I'm looking in the grocery store and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is this normal that I'm literally looking at an animal's ribs and a bunch of wings here? That does change the way I feel, and it makes me question the way I think, the way that you're causing me to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's in a lot of people's stories when they say they go vegetarian or vegan, they speak to something like that, where they recognize for the first time, maybe they see, like for me, when I saw it on a cooking show on PBS, and there was pig's heads hanging from a butcher shop in the program. And it just dawned on me, like, oh yeah, this is a person. For a lot of people, when they see that, they make that connection between the body parts and, you know, the whole animal that it once came from, that does spur them to kind of reconsider. But this is why that, and like I said at the beginning of the program, it's not just in the meat and dairy industry, but all the food industry. They package it in certain ways and make it look more appealing, to make you not think about the suffering, to make you not think about the bad things that might be within it. So that, you know, when they grind it up and cut it in certain ways and package it and put fancy labels on it, it encourages you to purchase it and not have to think about it. And, you know, that's strategic. You have entire industries built up around that, and people who have degrees in how to market and package things to make people want to purchase them.
This episode of Preconceived is sponsored by Epilogue Wills. Let me guess, you know you need a will, but you just haven't had time to get it done. With Epilogue Wills, you don't have to work around a lawyer's schedule. You can create it at home in as little as 20 minutes. Epilogue Wills are simple, smart, and legally binding. The online process is straightforward, affordable, and light on legal jargon. I created my own will using Epilog, and it was super easy. The platform is incredibly intuitive and user-friendly, and it literally took me 20 minutes to do. More importantly, I'm just happy that I took the 20 minutes to officially make my wishes known and do the important thing of putting a will together, which we all know we will need one day, yet all too often pushed to the future. So I highly recommend you to go to epilogwills.com and use the promo code PRECONCEIVED to save $20. That's epilogwills.com and use the promo code PRECONCEIVED. So what would you say to somebody who is listening to this and a lot of what you're saying is resonating with, but they're saying, I'm just so conditioned at this point. I've been eating meat my whole life. I've been eating eggs and cheese my whole life. What would you say is the next step if somebody wants to try and make a change, but they're struggling because they're saying, I've just been eating meat my whole life. It's really tough. I like meat. I like pizza. I like, and I know that you can have vegan pizza and all that, but how would you start?
Well, I would say that the time has never been easier than it is now. I've been vegan for 20 years now, vegetarian since, add three more years to that. So, I mean, I remember when I first started and it was, you maybe could find soy milk and maybe some veggie burgers in the frozen aisle. But nowadays you go to the grocery store and it's just there. It's everywhere. It's like so easy, especially here in England. But, you know, in the U.S., it's increasingly so as well. I'm thinking, I came from a very small town in Appalachia. And when I go back home to visit, I can get anything my heart desires in the grocery store now. The time's never been easier. But looking at the research, I can tell people like what makes the difference and what is more likely to keep you sticking with it. The main reason why a lot of people fall away from it, they give it a shot and aren't able to do it, is their social networks. So if you just don't have a strong backbone and you care a lot about what people think and you just want to fit in, you're just kind of one of those following type people, it's going to be a lot harder for you. You do have to kind of stand up a little straighter and say, this is what I'm doing and this is what I believe in, and have faith that after a few, and I'm not going to lie, it will take a few months before people start to be like, oh, okay, this is you now, and they start to accommodate and it's not a big deal anymore. I know I've been through so many of those awkward situations, but the longer you stick with it, the more people in your social circle become used to it. People will pick on you at first and make jokes, but then they'll get over it. You just have to hold strong and know that the research is there to support. The longer you stick with it, the easier it becomes. But the first part, the beginning of it, when you're learning new things to eat, when you have to check ingredients, and I rarely check ingredients anymore because I know I've been doing it for so long. And I don't have to negotiate awkward, I'm vegan, oh, sorry, I can't eat that. Like that goes away.
This apologetic type of framing.
Yeah. So that's the big thing, is the social networks part. So, I mean, I could give you all kinds of other advice, but ultimately you need to be thinking about, do I have friends in my network? Do I have a partner who's supportive? What about my family? Are they going to help me out? Or are they going to be a bit of resistance? Because that's going to be the make or break for you.
I mean, what you're saying certainly resonates with me, and it's tough for it not to resonate when you describe even just a few minutes worth of the abuse that is inflicted and the presumed ownership and hierarchical superiority over animals and the way that they're abused. It's tough for it really to not resonate. When raising children, is there a strong argument to, I know you'll agree, but is there a strong argument to raise your kids as vegans so that they can decide for themselves when they're older, such that they're not in that position where they have been indoctrinated to a system that then is harder to fall out of?
Yeah, I don't have kids myself, but I do know a lot of folks who are raising vegan kids, and I actually have one couple of vegan friends who are raising their kids not vegan, and they're just doing that because they just can't be bothered. Because it's difficult. It's really difficult because you have to negotiate with the preschool. And then of course the kid will feel left out if everybody's eating cupcakes and your kid doesn't have cupcakes. There's a pizza party and that, you know, all that kind of stuff, which I can't even begin to imagine if I were to have kids, how to deal with that. I think ethically speaking, medical institutions now across the world recognize that you can have healthy vegan pregnancies and raise healthy vegan kids. But yeah, ethically speaking, I would say, yeah, raise them vegan. I mean, if they're not going to be any worse off health-wise, why not? And then when they get older, if they feel like they do want to follow the crowd and, you know, be part of the dominant class and support violence, like, okay. I mean, they are individuals and they have their own agency. But I think what a gift it would be to start them off with a healthy plant-based vegan diet and teach them the ethics. Like I would teach my kid to reject racism or to reject sexism and to be kind to others. So why not also teach them about how that relates to non-human animals?
I say that because I just think it would be a lot easier to not have to give up meat, as we call it, or give up cheese and eggs if you were never really exposed to them in that same way. But I'm also not a parent, and I can imagine how difficult it would be to go against something so ingrained in society, not just for yourself, but for your kids. So it's very challenging. So I hear what you're saying on a moral standpoint, but also on a practical standpoint, it can be real challenging. Corey, thank you so much for taking this time to chat with me. Are there any final messages you would want to leave with people in addition to all the philosophy and sociological wisdom you've already provided today?
No, I would just say give peace a chance. Give veganism a chance. You can sign up for Veganuary or another one of those 30-day challenges, and they say it takes at least a month for habits to change. So give it a shot. Maybe get your friends and family involved and see how it treats you. And if you want to learn more, you're always welcome to come to my website at coreyleewren.com. I also have a newsletter. Yeah, just give peace a chance.
And I will put that in the episode notes for sure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you everybody for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.